The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 15th of May, 2020. On the podcast today, Paul Griffiths, CEO of Predator Oil and Gas. PRD is ticker there, and Paul provides a funding and operational update. Also on the podcast, Richard Edwards, CEO of Anpario, new company on the podcast, never had them on before. And Richard discusses the business model and the impact, which is a positive impact, of coronavirus on the business. And it's because they're involved, they describe themselves as a world leader in producing specialist feed additive technologies. And it's sort of natural based additives, which is very good, of course, when people are looking at supply chain foods, especially in light of the coronavirus crisis, which has come from animals. And so they may benefit from this. Worth checking out. Very interesting story. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about gold. Why people invest in it, some of the companies that are mining gold, they're paying dividends, and all that. Also, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. You can see top 10 versions of both these lists on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see our COVID-19 index. This is an index of 28 companies who trade well or could do well during the lockdown or during this period while we're looking for a vaccine. Then somewhere related, some of them are producing test kits, others are helping find a vaccine or antibodies. So check that out there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Griffiths, CEO of Predator Oil and Gas. PRD is a ticker. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Justin.
Yeah, on this wonderful, lovely blue sky day, sun's out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I suppose some good news coming from Predator here. You've sort of, redemption of the remaining sort of loan notes, and you've done a placing to do that, and we'll get into that in a bit. As always, the Paul, because there's several sections to the company. You're small in market cap, but a lot of potential there, because you've got quite a few projects going on. So just skim over the projects, if you could, quickly.
Okay, so just by way of introduction, I think it's important to state that our business is effectively to acquire, appraise and develop energy resources. And I say energy resources because we're mainly focused on gas. So that's always fitted our long established strategy of contributing to reduce CO2 emissions. And we only focus on markets and geographic regions where the level of CO2 emissions is disproportionately high per capita due to the over-reliance on carbon-intensive fossil fuels. And those countries at present where we have operations are Trinidad, Morocco and Ireland, because they all fit the strategy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, well, take us into this this convertible loan note redemption, if you could, Paul, on what it means to the company.
So yesterday's announcement, in my view, was extremely important as a significant, still the largest shareholder in Predator, because it confirmed that we had extinguished our debt. That was in the form of the Erato outstanding convertible loan. So whilst this debt instrument served us good purpose last year to build the Moroccan gas portfolio of prospects, which drives the growth potential in the share price going forward because of the materiality and size of Morocco. The market has changed this year, and COVID-19 has resulted in a very, very much weakened market that is beginning to recover. So in that respect, the convertible loan became an unwanted drag, a debt drag, if you like, on share price. And every time we made operational progress, the news was just diluted by the overhang of the debt. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, I think it's very important to have removed that debt overhang issue.
Yeah.
Furthermore, I'd say that we'd reached a point in order to repay that debt in cash, largely in cash, we reached a point where we had some discretionary cash from the oversubscribed fundraise that we did earlier this year. And we also had managed to introduce cost-cutting measures during COVID-19, which is a way, you know, for companies to focus on getting rid of any excess costs to reduce working capital requirements. And unfortunately, COVID-19 gave us the fortunate opportunity to do that. And moving on also to Trinidad, because we've made such great regulatory technical progress and operational progress to bringing revenue generation even nearer. We were very confident, even at $20 a barrel, West Texas, it's 28 this morning, that we would make cash out of Trinidad, and that would be sooner rather than later. So that would be supporting the working capital forecast as discretionary cash, which we hadn't factored into our firm commitments. So we're in a pretty good position then with the placing yesterday to pay off the loan with the placing cash plus some cash on our balance sheet, which allowed us to get rid of the loan. Now, the lender had a right within 48 hours of getting his notice to convert the entire loan to shares. But we negotiated a position where he'd convert a small amount or a smaller, much smaller amount into shares, which allowed us to reduce the cash requirement to pay him out. So we got rid of the loan and it's off our backs. And I'd say that's very, very positive as a shareholder, not just for the company.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. And I know sort of, you know, shareholders, when they see convertible loan notes being mentioned in RNSs, they tend to shiver. They go, oh, no.
You know, it's the uncertainty. Yeah. You're not knowing what's going to happen the next day. And the same for us as management. You know, we wake up wondering whether we're going to get a convertible loan notice. We can't control that process. Now, as I said, be absolutely fair about this. It served our purpose last year to create the opportunity in Morocco. Mm-hmm. And we still have $1.5 million in cash in the bank, in Morocco bank guarantee as a result of it. But this year, it just became far, far too onerous with the weakened market.
Yeah, absolutely. So okay.
Maybe I could just emphasize what that means for the impact on working capital forecast, because there's always a concern when you pay cash back. That, oh, what does this do to your current commitments? Well, rest assured, the repayment of the loan has no impact whatsoever on our working capital firm working capital requirements to deliver the Moroccan drilling program and progress Trinidad to revenue generation. So it has no impact there. But where it does have an impact is that by removing this, a positive impact is by removing the security the lender had over the cash coming back from the Moroccan bank guarantee, the first $1 million. It allows us to have that cash unfettered, which means that we can use that as leverage with service companies, for example, to say, look, we've got this cash coming back. If you drill the well at a competitive price and maybe a reduced price, you've got the certainty of cash coming back. We'll delay payments, etc. It allows us to use that as leverage to reduce our costs for drilling in a very weakened services market, you have to remember, and gives us the optionality then of potentially adding a second well if we can find the right kind of JV structure for that second well. And that's obviously got to be beneficial, because what we're doing is trying to target the gas market in Morocco, the immediate gas market. There's a longer term gas market of gas to power, which we've always stated is the objective of a very big gas discovery. It's hay fever, by the way, nothing else. Have a very big gas discovery for gas to power. But we have to look in the current climate of short-term solutions to gas monetization. So those solutions involved maybe up to 50 million cubic feet a day for the industrial market that is not served by gas as yet in Morocco, in Casablanca, for example, and the existing power market, which is just over 100 million cubic feet a day. And because we're close to the Maghreb pipeline, the power market, existing power market, is an option. And because we're close to the railroad, 8 kilometers from the railroad that serves Casablanca, shipping gas by some other means other than a pipeline is also a very attractive near-term development option. So that's why it's important to find a way maybe to drill a second well, an appraisal well, to get that whole thing moving very, very quickly towards monetization without working and waiting on longer-term scenario of gas to power for new build gas power stations, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And just operationally, everything going okay?
Yeah, Trinidad, as you saw from yesterday's announcement, is progressing. Mm-hmm. I would point out that, you know, you need to be patient with Trinidad. There is a process here that goes on and on with approvals, regulatory approvals, environmental approvals, at every stage in the project. When you move to another level, there are you've got to make sure that the box is ticked. And why this is important is, you know, ultimately we want to sell this business on. With all the boxes ticked, we have a very, very strong business to sell on. So, you know, patience is a great virtue. We're almost there. That's the key message now. We've done all the hard work, and we're not going to lose any momentum now simply because, you know, COVID-19, because we put in place measures where we can continue operations that continue around the clock, all through COVID-19, because of the way we set the system up and because of the way we have access to the site remotely by secure satellite internet communications and data transfer. So Trinidad is something that is not impacted by, for us, by COVID-19. On Morocco, it's a slightly different story. We're drill ready. Everything's prepared. Equipment is available in country. Rig is still stacked in country. So there are no issues there. All the approvals are in place. The fundamental issue is that we have to wait until COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed enough to move people across international frontiers. And that means, like, the expertise, the drilling rig crew who are specific to this rig, because it's a fully automated high-tech rig. You have to have specific people. You can't just go out and drag someone off the street in country. So that's the difference between Morocco and Trinidad. Morocco, we're more dependent on the lifting of restrictions imposed by COVID-19. And there is no way we as a company can tell you here and today where and when those restrictions are going to be such that we can move people across frontiers safely and cost effectively. That's for governments to decide, not this company. All we can say is we are drill ready as soon as those restrictions are lifted.
Yeah, I think we're starting to move that way, and most countries now have flattened that curve, I think, and the figures are coming down. So at least we seem to be over the top of the hill and coming down the other side, don't we?
We are over the top of the hill, but the bigger issue is simply how people are going to move across frontiers after this, and whether there'll be a 14-day quarantine restriction in all countries for new arrivals, etc. So that's the next step in the process. Don't think that lockdown immediately thinks that all governments are going to press the trigger on drilling operations resuming onshore. It's about understanding how people can freely move to the well site, operate at the well site, be moved in from another country and out of that country during crew changes, etc. So there's a lot more specifics to be worked out, and we're not in a position to know how those are going to be resolved at present.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Cool. And anything else to tell us?
No, I think I probably should summarise now on the three reasons to follow us. This is a shorter term reasons than I normally give. Obviously, the perceived debt overhang and the drag on the share price has been removed. And I guess, has any of you ever seen that great film Speed with
Keanu Reeves? Yeah.
Sandra
Bullock, yeah, Keanu Reeves, isn't it? Yeah.
You remember that the bus couldn't go more than 50 miles an hour without something drastic happening. So the drag of the debt is a bit similar. You can't go as fast as you like to improve share price because something drags you back. You know, there's a limit. Mm-hmm. So the second point I'd like to make is that Trinidad is proceeding as planned or during COVID-19 emergency because of the measures we put in place to keep operations going in the field for CO2 EOR. And there's great assistance from the ministry in Trinidad and from Heritage, the state company, during this time. You know, these guys are locked down as well, but they have permits, they have permission to enter the field, to do checks, to do approvals, etc., within the social distancing protocol that exists in Trinidad. So everything is on track in Trinidad. And again, I'd make the very key point here that it's not just about getting a flow rate. That's very important. It's about having a project that is saleable afterwards the CO2 EOR project in Trinidad is saleable because it's a high quality project, it ticks all the boxes, and it can be sold on as a greener business. And lastly, the Gersief drilling program remains funded and remains drill ready, and the scope now exists to drive more attractive, even more attractive commercial terms for services in a weakened services market on the basis that we are well financed, have approved drilling opportunities and a CO2 emissions reduction strategy that is consistent with what the investment ethics will be and are in terms of climate change concerns post COVID-19. And of course, service companies will be anxious to do work with a business up and running, ready to drill, ready to hand out contracts. And that gives us the upper hand for once over the service companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff, Paul. It's good to chat to you as always. And
thank you.
There's lots going on, so hopefully we catch up in not too distant future. Thanks very much.
We will. Thanks very much. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Edwards, Chief Executive Officer of Anpario. ANP is ticker there. Richard, thanks for joining me.
No, thank you, Justin, and good morning.
Yeah, it's good to get you on the podcast. Never spoken to you before. Always good to have a new company on. So for Richard, people not familiar with the company, just give us a brief summary as to what Anpario is all about, please.
Yeah, basically we manufacture specialty animal feed additives that would go into pig, poultry, dairy cow feed, and also aquaculture. And basically a small amount of our additives would go into the feed of the animal and improve gut health, which then leads to better performance of the animal for the farmer and better profitability for him. But we're also using natural compounds such as oregano oil, which is a naturally grown plant and a plant extract. And these sorts of products are really helping to reduce the amount of antibiotic use in global agriculture. So there's quite a good growing trend of trying to replace antibiotics. We manufacture in the UK and supply in over 80 countries around the world.
Do you know what? I was very surprised as to how much antibiotics are used generally, you know, traditionally in animal feed and all that stuff. And animals completely, and of course, that's affecting the effectiveness of antibiotics overall, doesn't it, for humans and everything.
Well, exactly. I think I can't remember the exact figures, but I think somewhere in the US and probably around the world, there's probably more antibiotics used in animal production than there is by humans. Mm. But there is a massive growing trend to remove them. The US has really probably got ahead of, in some ways, the rest of the world, certainly in poultry. Where when they say no antibiotics ever, then they mean it. There won't have been any antibiotic used in growing that chicken meat. But even places like China are getting pretty aggressive on removing antibiotics from their production. So it's a growing trend. But you know, we shouldn't be negative about antibiotics. What we have to do is use them sensibly, so that when we need them. And, you know, in cases like we're going through with COVID-19, you know, when we need antibiotics, they are effective. But unfortunately, the overuse of them has meant that they've been less effective and there's been antibiotic resistance. And the animal production sector has been, you know, a problem with that, because it has meant that antibiotics that have been used in humans and animals have developed antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand it's now sort of an historical document, and it was released a few weeks back as well, a few months back, but your final results are out. So just to give us a sense of where you are financially and operationally, just give us some highlights, if you could, from that, Richard.
Yeah, as a number of people may know, we built up the business through a number of acquisitions. So we've gradually integrated those over the last sort of 10 years, driven out the costs and efficiencies and the synergies. But we've also tended to focus on the higher margin products. So there will be some low sort of margin, high volume commodity stuff that we have sort of got rid of over the last number of years. So our underlying sales and gross profit has grown But that, you know, profitability has grown probably stronger because we're focused on higher margin added value products. So in the results, we grew 3%. The revenue grew by 3%, which actually was a good result given that the agricultural market around the world last year was pretty tough, particularly when you look at China had African swine fever and they basically culled 50% of their pig herd in China. They're now gradually restocking and rebuilding that back. If you look at our gross profit, then we grew that by 7%, and our basically our EBITDA profitability grew by 6% in 2019. We have a very strong balance sheet. We have no debt. We had, I think, about £13 million on the balance sheet. And I think the only thing that we borrow or lease is probably a photocopier. So we have an extremely strong balance sheet, which has obviously put us in a good position going into this COVID-19 crisis.
Yeah. Well, and so you say you're, you know, pretty much around the world. Is there any one geography where you, you know, you get the main source of your revenue from?
No, the bigger countries that would still be less than 10% would be China, where we have our own subsidiary and our own team. The US, that would be, again, I think 9-10%. And that we have our own team there. It's our own subsidiary. Brazil's growing pretty nicely at the moment. And you know, the Philippines has been quite a big territory. But generally, I think everywhere is you know, there's not one, there's not a customer that's bigger than 5 or 6%, and there's not a country that's really bigger than 10%. We're hoping that the US will grow to be you know, a bigger proportion of the company because it's such an important market. It's obviously one of the biggest markets, and you know, our products go in there under a good legislative sort of process, and they are moving, as I said, pretty rapidly to antibiotic free in a lot of their production.
Yeah. And you mentioned recently you've done a COVID-19 update. Of course, it's affecting every business in the world, pretty much. So what's the deal here? What impact are you seeing from the coronavirus?
Well, it's been positive, thankfully, for us. We are in the food supply chain. You know, as I say, we keep the animals healthier. We actually build up their immune system. And as I sort of mentioned, the oregano oil product, that's one active that we use. We also use a formic acid, which is a very antimicrobial. So it kills things like Salmonella and E. coli. These products are also antiviral. So they will help to control things like African swine fever, avian influenza. And we have proof of their antiviral properties. So, you know, it is important that our products are continued to be used and they are in the food supply chain, and keeping the supermarket stock full of chicken, pork and you know, other protein is very important. So we had, you know, as we went into the beginning of March, we had a significant increase in orders. Mm-hmm. Some of that will have been stocking by our distributors and our subsidiaries and also customers. But what's happened further down the line, a lot of farmers have got worried, is there going to be any supply disruption? So they've increased the production of feed to make sure they've got higher stocks. But we've also been able to win some market share, and where other competitors haven't been able to supply, we've picked up some business from that. But also our guys around the world, we have staff and sales teams around the world, have been able to continue business development with the customers locally, predominantly through things like I'm speaking to you today, Justin, through Microsoft Teams. Oof. So we've been able to continue our business development with customers, you know, around the world with our local team. So we have had a very good 2 months, March and April, and we're sort of excited about the next few months. Obviously, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. We haven't had much disruption on raw material supply, and we've been able to ship our products internationally. We have sort of, we put in measures in place in the production plant where we split the shifts, done social distancing. We sent generally everyone home from the offices. But and when one or two people did go off, either with symptoms or because they had to self-isolate because they felt someone might have had COVID-19 at home or in their family, then we actually had our management accountant and our corporate development director and actually another accountant working on the production line for a couple of weeks. But touch wood, no one, thankfully, no one in the company appears to have had coronavirus. So we've had, you know, we've had some very strong months, and we're sort of looking forward to hopefully keeping that up, being able to take some market share, and also maybe look for some acquisition opportunities if there are some companies with weaker balance sheets than ours.
Yeah. And by the way, in that update there, so you, I think say you're on a very interesting space here, especially at the moment. But in that update, you've announced a patent application. And is the first, or do most of your products, are they protected? Are their own IP, protected?
Generally, that we don't have many patents, or we don't have patents. The reason is because we really work like the Coca-Cola syrup formulation is the secret is in the actual formulation.
Yeah.
So for the oregano product, which is our leading product and is probably the market leader around the world, you know, it's very the way that we our supplier processes that natural oregano oil to a very tight specification. It gives it a very high consistency, and that consistency of the compounds in there that are doing the job is important to make sure that then the farmer gets the same consistency of performance in his animals when the animals have consumed it. So, but it's not just the oil, it's then the mineral carrier systems that we turn it into a powder, and then our packaging, you know, it has to be a special sort of packaging to maintain 2 years shelf life on the product for because otherwise the active, the oregano oil or the organic acid will deteriorate over time. So our packaging has to be quite special. So it is very much in our know-how and our formulations. Sometimes we do shy away from doing patents because that would give too much information away to our competitors, but there are a number of developments that we've got that we feel are worth patenting, and particularly when you can get, I think it's a 10% tax patent box. But the patent that you're mentioning was into really the dairy sector, where we're able to reduce and show that we have reduced the antimicrobial resistance within dairy calves who have been fed what they term as sort of waste milk from the cow. From the mother, because that waste milk can't go for human consumption because there may be antibiotic residues in there, but it is in Europe given to the calf. So we have we've been able to sort of show that benefit, and we decided to patent it because the work was done with University of Reading, and they were saying, you know, this is pretty unique and a very, you know, very good finding. And so we felt this is worth protecting, doing, and it also helps having a patent for marketing purposes. Mm-hmm. You know, customers do sort of like to see, okay, it's got a patent, let's look at it in more detail. But that's generally how our IP works. It's a lot more on know-how, the formulations and knowledge of producing that product.
Yeah, absolutely. And so looking forward then, Richard, what's your thoughts in, you know, for 2020?
Yeah, well, it's getting through to 2020, I think. You know, we're not sure where the second half will go with this COVID-19. What we have found, I mean, I'm speaking to you from my home, is that we are we're able to very effectively work with Microsoft Teams, and it has brought some benefits in that bringing the team internationally closer together. So, you know, my commercial director, who looks after the regional directors and the sales teams around the region, is regularly, you know, on Microsoft Teams every week with his team. We're also doing sales training, sort of in-house sales training that we're doing with, you know, people in Asia, people in the US, Latin America, Middle East teams. So we're doing that through Microsoft Teams, and that has really pulled the company together. Whereas before, we would have been flying around the world, and you know, I would have been probably doing a long haul flight every other month. My commercial director probably would have been doing long haul every month. And we've probably realized that maybe we don't need to be doing that so much. And that, so travel costs, you know, hopefully we won't have to be spending as much on travel costs and accommodation. But also trade shows, we're cancelling, all the trade shows are being cancelled, and we don't feel has that necessarily added value in the past. So we're quite hopeful that, I mean, there's a saying, isn't there, don't waste a good crisis.
Yeah.
And so there's certainly things we are finding out that we can work quite effectively remotely using, as I say, things like Microsoft Teams, that we'll probably retain going forward and make us maybe a little bit more efficient and more effective in some ways. But we for the future, you know, in terms of the sales growth, then it's good. You know, the human population is growing. The legislation is only going to tighten up to move away from, overuse of antibiotics and also think nasty substances like formaldehyde, which have been used in animal feed to clean the feed of from Salmonella and E. coli. That's been banned in Europe, and it is being banned elsewhere around the world. And we have a substitute product that can replace that type of nasty substance. So we're for the rest of 2020, we're quite hopeful. We think that this could be a good year for us. And as I say, so far it has shown to be strong sales growth.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Richard, well, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies. So to get on that list, someone has to hit the follow button. So give us three reasons right now why someone should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, firstly, growth trends. You know, as a growing human population, if you look at emerging markets, GDP growth in those markets is going to be higher. And as people get more GDP, then they spend more on meat protein. So, and particularly things like chicken, where 60% of our business is into chicken. So there's some very good economic population drivers. And a lot of, you know, I think there's more, if you draw a circle around China, sort of India and Southeast Asia, more people live in that circle than outside of that circle. You know, we have very strong positions in China and Southeast Asia. The legislation is also moving our way, as I said, about antibiotics moving away from harmful substances. So, you know, environmentally, socially, and you know, corporate governance, the ESG band, we're very much in that, using natural products to help produce safer, healthier meat protein for the agricultural industry. We have a strong balance sheet. As I said, we don't, you know, we probably lease a photocopy would be the only thing that would show up as a sort of a debt. And a leased Regus office that we have in Milton Keynes. But we had, I think, yeah, just at the end of last year, 13.8 million on the balance sheet in cash. And I think I announced in the COVID update a similar sort of amount. So we are cash generative. We have high operational gearing that just drops to the bottom line. So it just reinforces the strength in that balance sheet. And we have some unique products. You know, the Oregano product is very much up and coming plant extract that is well known around the world. And we are dealing with some of the biggest integrators around the world, you know, in the US, in the UK, Philippines, Thailand, with those products. So strong products, strong balance sheet, strong growth trends.
Excellent stuff. Richard, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yes, in good health. Thank you, Justin. You?
Yeah, I'm okay. Do you know what? I was just thinking that a while back, I sometimes, I know patience is the thing with investing. It's, you know, it's discipline and patience. One of the two things you have to get right. And I bought into gold, an ETF, a gold ETF, and I'm going to talk about gold right now, literally about 3 months before the sort of breakout happened, and and I sold it about 2 weeks before, months before.
Good for you, and then bad for you.
And then I thought, and then it started to rally. I thought, oh no! Oh. And then I did the same again about a month later, and it rallied again just before. And I thought, and to be honest, let me just get the gold chart up here because a lot of people say it's bound to rally because you know the Fed are diluting the money and just printing money like crazy, and people are going to go for hard assets like gold.
That's the argument. Yeah. And, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Or one of them. And also the other, and also governments are running up colossal deficits. So you can argue that they are, you know, albeit for understandable reasons, you know, you can argue that they are abusing money. And if the money, you know, if you can say that at the moment they're handing out money, which up to a point is unearned, they're providing valuable, vital support to people, but people are trapped at home, so there's actually nothing productive being done to generate it.
Yeah.
Then they've been given money that's unearned. You can argue they've been given money that's actually not worth terribly much. And again, that's one thing that, you know, certainly Austrian economists would argue. And maybe that's another reason why gold's at, what, 1740 an ounce or something as we speak right now?
1741, yes. Do you know what? I remember it was in January of 2019, and I was at around 1300, and it went up a little bit. I thought, oh, here we go, because I was convinced it was going to go crazy. And then it sort of just started petering off and went down to about 1270. I thought, get out of that. And then literally, if you look about a month later, it went up to about $1,500. And I thought, oh no.
Yeah, no, you'll know more about this than me as the charts man, but I think there was a sort of big resistance level at 1350, 1316. Several times. And once it popped through that, as you said, straight to 1500 and off it went.
Well, I thought that's why I got up. So it went up to it again, it tested again, failed, and it came back down. And I'm out then. And then all of a sudden, within weeks, it just shot straight through it. And I thought, oh, okay, fair enough, I missed that one then. And it's just about having patience. I know you should have a bit of gold in the portfolio. You know, I often say this, and I don't do it. And but there we are. So what's the argument for holding? I mean, a lot of people go for sort of either explorers or miners or producers. I mean, what's the thought here?
The arguments for it are that you are seeing huge amounts of central bank money creation and governments running colossal fiscal deficits. And some people argue that gold is a hedge against inflation. Some people argue that it's a hedge against deflation. My suspicion actually is it's a bit of a hedge against governments not being in control of the situation and central banks not being in control. Now, they're confronted by a fiendish situation at the moment, a pandemic. And whatever they do is going to upset some people, and whatever they do is not going to be right for some people or enough. And it's a very difficult position to find themselves in.
Yeah.
But if you look at when gold really, really thrived in, say, the middle of the last decade towards the start of the 06 to 11 or 12, I think there was that sense that actually central banks were gone from being masters of their own destiny to what on earth do we do now?
Yeah.
And I think there's an element of that now, where I saw a statistic from Bank of America this week that you've seen various bodies say that the global hit to GDP will be about $9 trillion this year, which is about a 10% drop in global GDP. Who knows? But it seems like as good an estimate as any right now. And Bank of America have added up the numbers, and I think this was before India's $250 billion stimulus package this week. And they've said, well, actually, central banks and governments have so far thrown $18 trillion at it. In fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, which is not small potatoes. Now, obviously, hopefully it'll see us through. But again, the argument from gold bugs would be there's a bill to pay here. There's lots more money in circulation. Who's to say it doesn't actually start moving very quickly once people are actually let out of their houses? Could there be inflation? Deflationists will say, actually, there's a big problem here. You've got a demand side shock that's not going to go away. Lots of people are going to lose their jobs. There's going to be deflation. But I think the argument for gold is, they're not on top of the situation. Now, it's unfair to expect them to be on top of the situation. Their response is massive, but it doesn't mean that they're in control, and that's one of the reasons why people might just latch onto gold as a hedge against, frankly, anything possibly happening.
Yeah, well, it's the obvious trade, isn't it, really, when you think of it? And sometimes, because of that, I don't do it. It's like it's too obvious. I mean, is everyone saying gold's going to be higher? Can it go higher? You know, it's like the markets. Everyone thinks the markets should be going lower, but it's rallied recently, of course, in part due to the Fed and stuff.
And markets will often do what causes the maximum amount of pain and embarrassment to people, unfortunately. Because, you know, in the end, why do they move up or down? It's because there's an incremental buyer or an incremental seller, i.e. somebody has changed their mind, and that's what's actually moving the market. Now, in terms of gold, I mean, there is obviously a very clear case against it, which is one, central banks and governments are going to get on top of this. there will be a solution, whether it's the lockdown, whether it's a vaccine, whatever it happens to be, or people just slowly inching back into their lives. The money printing will ease off. The fiscal deficits will be tackled through taxes or whatever it happens to be. So that's one argument, that in the end they will get back in control. Another argument is gold is in the end an inert lump. And as Warren Buffett once said, if a Martian came down to Earth and fell over a load of it, he wouldn't know what to do with it, or she wouldn't know what to do with it, because it's got no, virtually no industrial use. It offers no yield, and it just sits there and it's heavy. And so that's another argument against it. So you don't have to fall in love with it. But the counter to the Buffett argument, at least, is it generates no yield, it generates no cash, is that that's what gold miners can do when things are really buzzing. And that, I think that's one of the things that I thought we'd talk about this week, was that given that we've seen 43 FTSE 100 companies cut, defer, cancel, suspend either ordinary or special dividends because they're hunkering down for cash. If you look at the HUI Gold Bugs Index in New York, the NYSE-HUI, the HUI, it's the HUI index. If you look at the 10 biggest constituents of that by market cap, their free cash flow has gone from $570 million to $5.6 billion in the last 5 years, mainly because the gold price has gone up, but also because there's been the odd acquisition here from Newmont and Barrick, so they've got bigger, for example. There's been some consolidation. But this is a niche sector that actually is currently rolling in cash, and it's really motoring. And actually, Newmont have just increased their quarterly dividend payment by 50%, 60%, 70%. And I suspect that a few of the good ones will follow. So at a time when investors are looking around thinking, well, you know, where is there any, as intriguingly, might be about to start ramping up their dividend just when a lot of other people are cutting them. The rub on that is that the yield on those 10 names isn't very big. It's about 1.5%. But the aggregate dividends they're forecast to pay this year is still barely half what they paid at the peak of the gold price in 11-12. So there is potentially something to go for there.
Yeah.
If you think obviously gold is going to hang tough, if you think gold's going to go back down, then you know the cash flow starts to dry up and we're back to where we were 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's like one of the things, it's like the, again, you know, stock markets, look at the price always. When you see it in all-time low, 12-month low, it's worth it, even an ETF maybe, just but you know, topping up on or buying or going into it. But at the moment, I don't want to sort of, if it goes up to, let's say, 2,000, what percentage yield is that? I mean, I'm just thinking, I maybe get a better deal on stocks with dividends. I don't know. That's my thought, and I don't know.
I think the gold miners, I mean, clearly provide you, I mean, the gold price, if it goes up, a senior gold miner will provide more leverage into that because their profits and cash flow will go up more quickly. Mm-hmm. And a junior gold miner, providing he's actually digging something out of the ground or is about to, will clearly offer even more leverage into that. But again, that's on the upside. The flip side of that is if gold goes down, your senior gold miner's share price, profits and cash flow will go down faster, and your junior gold miner's ones will go down even faster still. So it's a matter of where you want to be on the risk spectrum. I mean, again, these ETFs that you can get that track the senior gold miners or the junior gold miners' baskets, if anything, frankly, probably the easiest way of going about it, because you know, you look, when you look at individual gold miners, there are all sorts of different things that you have to consider. I mean, they're all in sustaining cost is clearly a key factor here. Yeah. You know, the lower the better, because the fatter their margin. I mean, Newmont's AISC right now is probably about $900. So with gold at 1,700, I mean, we're talking money for jam here, okay? Yeah. But clearly there are things that you need to consider. I mean, the cost, where the gold price is going to go, where do they operate? Is there any risk of assets being sequestered or taxed by, you know, nationalistic governments that want a bigger share of the pie, for example?
And generally, the gold producers, most of them are not in friendly jurisdictions, or they're all in, you know.
No, I think if you can, trying to focus on places like Canada and America and Australia is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
I think if you're if you are operating in Africa, then there is the risk that the local government just decides it wants a bigger piece of the action. So that's something you've got to. Where do they operate? Is it in a jungle? Is it in a forest? Mm. You know, could be weather risks, for example. So that's another. You need to look at the balance sheet. You need to look at management acumen and management track record. So there are lots and lots of different things that you can think. And things just can and do go wrong because of the weather, a mudslide, a strike by the staff, whatever it is. So probably a basket of these things is probably the way to go forward, because if you're relying on one or two names, something unexpected just... I mean, at the moment, we still have to think about COVID. Mm. You know, if you were to get a COVID outbreak at one particular mine, then that would knock that out for a little bit. It might be good for the gold price overall, but bad for the miner in specific. Obviously, clearly terrible news for the staff. So again, I think spreading your risk if you want to get some leverage into gold through a basket of gold miners is probably a safer way than nailing your colours to one or two particular gold miners. I think would be the way I would look to do it if I was allowed to, which I'm not, and I have to leave it to my financial advisor to decide what we think is the appropriate thing to do. But I do believe there is some gold exposure in the pot somewhere along the lines for reasons that we've just discussed.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how, you know, some investors, well-known investors, swear by having gold. What's that guy from the... Jim Roberts.
Rogers.
Rogers. He's always... talked about gold non-stop, then you get Buffett's not a fan of it, but they both
very
successful.
Have anything to do with it at all.
It's very odd, isn't it, how you can get two different kind of, you know, very sort of successful investors and they're playing at opposite ends of the spectrum.
That's what makes a market, right? And again, there is no right answer for all people. I mean, another way of looking at gold is you could maybe do it through, if you wish to, a multi-asset fund, like say Trojan, for example, which is very crudely split between gold, cash, bonds, and equity income, because, you know, Sebastian Lyon, who runs the portfolio, is smart enough to know he doesn't have a crystal ball, he doesn't know what's coming around the corner, and rather, like, you know, sort of Dylan Grice's old cockroach portfolio, he's looking to build something that's relatively indestructible, no matter what the world throws at the portfolio. There's inflation, deflation, stagflation, growth, whatever, and that fund very, very rarely loses your money. I can't actually think of the last time it actually had a down year. Because again, if you think about it, yes, if there's inflation, okay, maybe your bonds don't do so well, but your equity income might bail you out, your gold will dig you out. If there's a recession, your bonds will look okay, your cash will give you a bit of defense. So that's the way that portfolio. So that's maybe another option, again, for, say, a more risk-averse investor. And I think Sebastian's got a bit of physical gold in there and possibly the odd gold miner as well. So again, there isn't a right solution for all investors because it comes down to your personal appetite for risk, possibly even how much you've got to play with. So, but again, a lot of it will be... But I think people do... exactly going according to plan, and central banks being behind the curve, not on top of it, which I think is also, unfortunately, probably where we are right now, despite their best efforts.
Okay, one more question for you then, Russ.
Tell me.
This is almost $7 trillion, or even more than that, $19 trillion question. How do governments cope with this debt? How do they unwind this debt? Because even in good times, we've seen them building up the debt pile, the deficit gets wider. So how on earth, and does it actually count in the end? Because they can just print money, can't they?
Well, I think this is why gold bugs are beating their chest, because there was clearly massive stimulus of fiscal and monetary after the great financial crisis. There was a decade of austerity. The debts did come, you know, but the debts didn't grow as quickly. Annual deficits shrank, but aggregate deficits rose. So that stimulus wasn't withdrawn. And then we've walked slack bang into the next crisis. So I think that's why people are again looking at gold, and Austrians would point to gold saying, well, this stimulus will just never be withdrawn, if you don't mind, because the damage is just too great, and the knock-on effect of that afterwards. I think we are probably going to be looking at, I think, austerity. I think politically is going to be very, very hard for politicians to persuade people of the need for it.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of spending cuts, I think politicians will find that a very hard sell. I think there will be some public appetite for increases in corporation tax. And I think there may be politicians turning to other areas where perhaps less popular, but things that are harder to avoid, like VAT. I do think we will be looking at tax increases going forward. I think VAT is possibly a bit unfair because it hits earners of all income brackets. And I think there will be a case made for higher earners taking a hit, but they already pay out a very big percentage of the tax by anyway. So again, there's no easy solution, but I think you will be looking at higher levies when we come out of this. Does it matter? I think it's one of those situations that it doesn't matter until it does. And I think as long as you can preserve confidence, then I think you're fine. But I think the more you print and the faster you do it and the further you go down the rabbit hole, I think more confidence ebbs away. And let's just look at it in this way. Since the euro was established in 1999, it's lost 80% of its value against gold.
Yeah.
And now that is, you know, you might say, well, that's the other way, just saying gold's gone up 80% in euro terms, right?
Yeah.
But the ECB is printing money hand over fist and it's talking about more. And this is the market saying, actually, we just don't have an awful lot of faith in your ability to get your way out of this. And I think the eurozone at the moment does face some fairly serious questions. Again, it's in a very difficult, or it's in the same difficult position as everybody else in terms of how to deal with the crisis. But if you look at the eurozone per se, it's yet to agree on a policy, or is yet to find a policy that all members agree upon. with the result that you've got the German Constitutional Court saying that more QE is illegal. You've got the Italians begging for assistance, the Germans not offering it. So if you're a European citizen paying your taxes, the one thing that you're relying upon your government to do here is to provide you with assistance in this scenario. And I don't say this is anti-European, by the way, under any circumstances. So this is not to make a political point. But I think if you're a citizen paying taxes for something and your government is failing to help you in your hour of greatest need, that raises some fairly interesting existential questions about whether you should pay your taxes to fund the existence of an unelected body that is actually, in the end, just failing to help you. Now, that is not, I'm not making a political point, even if it sounds like it, but it's a big question that the EU will need to address effectively in the next 12 to 18 months if there are not to be more questions asked about the edifice that is the Eurozone and the single currency.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. You're going to say, well, what are you there for if you're not to help us out?
That's what I'm trying to say politely. And I don't want to upset pro-EU people because this is a politics-neutral podcast. But it's a question that the longer this goes on is going to bubble up to the surface, I think.
Yeah, well, it's the same of any government, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, I've seen people, funny enough, on Twitter saying, you know, and you've got to question the cost of what's happening. Because I looked at the stats this morning and I said, do you know what? 118 times as many Americans have lost their job than people have lost their lives globally to the coronavirus. So you have to question the economics of that because that is huge.
And there is a long-term cost.
And so we've got to say now, okay, when you realise that, and originally I'm all for it was lockdown to stop the spread, but you've got to realise that, you know, 75% of people have pre-existing health conditions, of the people who die, 80% above 60. So yeah, you're locking down all the economy and literally most people will never be affected. So you've got to look at the cost of that. And if the government's aren't helping you out when they've put this lockdown in place, you think, well, what are you there for? If you can't get the economy back on track and help us all out, there's no point of a government, is
there,
really?
It's an invidious choice that politicians have got. If they don't help people and the death numbers go up, that's a very easy way to measure government failure. And clearly nobody wants to lose a loved one under any circumstances like that. Equally, there is potential, as you said, for enormous long-term damage to the economy. The more people lose their jobs now, the harder it could be for them to get back. And there are lots of stats on stress-related illnesses and stress-related cancers coming out of the financial crisis. We've seen the numbers today on the collapse in the number of people going to A&E, possibly because they're just too frightened rather than they don't want to feel they're getting in the way of deserving COVID cases. So those, however, are a little bit harder to measure. And therefore, I think if I was a politician looking to be seen to be doing a good job, you're going to crack on with the COVID thing, A, because it's measurable, and B, because it's frightening, and C, because we don't quite know what it still means. So you could be opening things up. But yeah, there is a potential long-term economic issue coming around the corner in terms of funding of deficits and taxes, but also, you know, how quickly we can come back from this. We know that stock markets have priced in a fairly rapid recovery, but, you know, they've had a little bit of a wobble this week, partly because the Fed hasn't been pumping in as much money, as I know you're checking very carefully. Yes. And also because there are just second thoughts creeping in about how fast people can or want to go back to work or feel safe to go back to work. And whether they, you know, therefore will then start spending their pounds and whether companies will start investing again. So it's from a government's perspective, it's fiendish. I think ultimately I would rest, and again, this is not to make a pro-party point anyway. I've always been with Dennis Healey, the former Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, in terms of what constitutes good government, which is stable prices, none of this 2% inflation a year cobblers that were rammed down our throat. I think that's nonsense. Stable prices, jobs for those that want them, support and training for those that can't get them. And I think that's, as a three-point plan, pretty good.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Russ, thanks for that. I keep forgetting we're in lockdown.
Any plan?
I'm getting used to the fact that it's nice weather. I've got a garden. I say, any plans for the weekend?
So there'll be a bit of garden action. I'm going to go for a walk up to the local off licence later on today, see what craft beers they've got for me to try out this weekend. Now we can take a bit more exercise.
Yeah.
Our lad is now able to go to the cricket net at the club near us and play cricket with a mate, so long as we all socially distance and they all just use their own ball and don't touch the ball and all that. So I think we'll be trying to get a little bit more exercise into the kids and you know, go for a walk ourselves and maybe, you know, talk to a couple of mates, albeit a respectable social distance.
Marvellous stuff. Have a nice one. I'll speak next week.
Take care.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Omega Diagnostics, that's ODX, up 10% to 54.75 at 4 Arena Events, and that is 7 pence, up 2% pretty much. At 3, Aston Martin Lagonda, that's up 6.7% at 32 pence. At 2, Tiziana Life Sciences, up 3% at 87.5. And at 1, Avacta Group, up 36.15% to 145. Okay, time for the top 5 most liked RNSs. At 5, Starcom, conversion of director's deferred salary. At 4, Asia Met Resources, receives key approval for BKM project. At 3, EVR Holdings, Melody VR launched content studio and live from LA. At 2, it's Avacta Group, SARS-CoV-2 neutralizing affirmers. And at 1, Tizian Life Sciences, ASCO conference, Michelebidib, whatever that is, but they're up on that. So it's announces an online publication of 2 abstracts at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, reporting clinical activity and safety of Michelebidib in patients with advanced hepatocellular carcinoma. Can't find a hard work pronouncing this. That's TIS. TILS is up 3% to 87.5 pence. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.